This is in Scripture, primarily if you would turn your Bibles to Proverbs chapter 1. One of the things that we would point out to you about the Thessalonian church that was said to them, about them, in that book, in the 8th verse, it says, "For from you sounded out the word of the Lord, not only in Macedonia and Achaia, but in every place your faith to Godward is spread abroad." That that it was said that the word, they sounded out the word, it means to reverberate. It echoed. There was an extensive hearing of the scriptures as the Thessalonian Christians went forward. And I find in reading through Proverbs chapter 1, there's some interesting observations. I want to go through the markers here, and then come back and detail just a little bit. I'd like to begin reading in Proverbs chapter 1 at verse 7. And just address my remarks in a narrow sense about reverberation tonight. And I find in here a corollary between this and what was said of the Thessalonians in that 8th verse in the New Testament. Verse number 7 says, "The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, but fools despise wisdom and instruction. My son, hear the instruction of thy father, and forsake not the law of thy mother. For they shall be an ornament of grace unto thy head, and chains about thy neck." And we begin our reading with a note there at verse 10. When you think about the matter of personal evangelism, our target, first of all, is seen in verse 10 in the word sinners. "My son, if sinners entice thee, consent thou not." Our target group is a sinner. Just simply put, that a sinner in a civil sense is a criminal, like unto the fellows that hung on each side of the Lord at Calvary. They are criminals. Theologically, a sinner is someone who is just a rebel with respect to the lawgiver, the Lord. So there's your target. If you're interested at all in fulfilling the commands of God with regard to personal evangelism, there is not a lack anywhere you go for targets. Now, there's something else to be said in verses 11 through 14 and 16 through 19. You see the trouble therein, secondly, and the trouble that they cause by their very nature. It is said, if they say, "Come with us, let us lay wait for blood. Let us lurk privily for the innocent without cause. Let us swallow them up alive as the grave, and whole as those who go down into the pit. We shall find all precious substance. We shall fill our houses with spoil." Then down in verse 16, "Their feet run to evil and make haste to shed blood." Then in verse 19, it sort of gives the hint. There's a hint there of the engine that drives the criminal machine in verse 19. We'll talk about that in a minute. But just note the trouble that they cause, the trouble that they're into, and that which alienates them from our holy God, sinners. In light of that, we see at verse number 20, there is the telling. "Wisdom crieth without, she uttereth her voice in the streets. She crieth in the chief place of concourse, in the openings of the gates in the city. She uttereth her words, saying, How long, ye simple ones? Will ye love simplicity, and scorners delight in their scorning, and fools hate knowledge?" So there's a telling there in the streets, in the chief place of the concourse, in the opening of the gates, and in the city. And then we have the hope that as a result of the telling or the personal evangelism of the individual, that there would be a turning in verse 23. A turning. This is what we hope for. Whenever you speak to sinners, that it would be our desire that they would turn you at my reproof. Now, there's a load here to be spoken about with regard to the nature of the testimony that runs directly counter the prevalent contemporary evangelistic model. And we'll comment in a moment about that. Then one of the things that we must take into consideration, and it does have a bearing on our attitude and our worth, our personal worth in evangelism, is what we read in verse 24 and 25, that even in spite of your telling, there will be those who turn away. They will turn away. Because I have called and ye refused, I have stretched out my hand and no man regarded, but ye have said it not all my counsel and would none of my reproof. They turn away. Some will. And let's come quickly to an understanding about our responsibilities where personal witness is concerned. God did not in any place among all the major and commonly referred to evangelistic passages ever commission us the responsibility of manipulating the choice or the outcome with regard to the matter of evangelism. Our commission, very simply put, is to be seed sowers. And we need to be 100% effective in that. On every occasion where there is a targeted sinner, we sow the seed. It's God's business to take the seed and grow or bring out of that seed life. That's not on you and me. And yet there, a lot of people have become discouraged and demoralized, even worse, because they do not see fruit in their personal evangelistic efforts. And yet the truth of the matter is, if we are faithful in sowing the seed 100% of the time, and that involves the telling, that there's something to be said about a sustained faithfulness. And there's also something else here, because if the individual that you tell turns away, there's tragedy waiting. And we find that in verse 26. I also will laugh at your calamity. Now, if you saw the pictures, the horrible news pictures today out in Illinois and in the Midwest where the tornadoes blew through there, there were buildings down, buses overturned, children injured. That calamity, which it is, pales in comparison to what's coming for the sinner. There he says, I will mock when your fear cometh. When your fear cometh, then there's three things to note here. Desolation in verse 27. Destruction. And also distress. And the resulting anguish that comes out of that. The anguish. And then there's something else to be noted here in verse 28. With regard to time. Time. It's not without its limits. They shall call upon me, but I will not answer. They shall seek me early, but they shall not find me. There is a time when time runs out. God only Himself knows when He is finished with His appeals to the sinner. We don't have an eye on the clock. But understand this, and the sinner must understand that there comes a time when God withdraws Himself from the sinner and turns away from them. And time runs out. We'll talk to that too. And then there is this at the bottom of the chapter, the tranquility that is promised by the Lord, the resting that is promised to the one who will listen to the truth. Whoso hearkeneth unto me shall dwell safely and shall be quiet from fear of evil. So I've given you these these markers, let me go back to the first one, to the target. In verse number 10, the target is the sinner. I don't think there needs to be much explanation on what the word entice means. To bait. And when I look at that and I consider, I know that you know this, but I want you to remember as much as possible this foundational premise in personal evangelism. And that foundational premise is separation. Now, that may seem like a contradiction. For if we're trying to reach out to people, how then, what's the point of the separation? Well, I will just have you think about this. There must be a distance. There must be a distance maintained due to a clash of cultural and moral appetites. For example, if the sinner would succeed in enticing you into his or her company, what credibility would your witness have in their midst? And so there has to be that distance maintained. And I want you to think about this a little bit deeper about the enticement. I mean, it may seem rather facetious, but, you know, we're talking here about a gang of thieves and muggers. But I want you to know that that this is a good way to earn a living. You realize that, you know, a thief and a mugger that's described here like this, he has no boss, doesn't keep any certain hours, and it's highly lucrative at times. And it's really simple. I mean, you just wait for an elderly woman to come walking down a sidewalk, take her purse and run away. What's she going to do? What's she going to do? She's not going to outrun you. She's going to chase you down. She's not got enough strength to throw a stone and bring you down. That's easy money. She may have in her purse a wad of bills stick in your pocket. And so the ringleader says to you, hey, look at this. Every night we have this and we just split it up evenly among us. Let's have one, what they say about the purse here, verse 14. Let's all have one purse. Share and share alike. You know, if we get $100, everybody gets an even part about that. And your reasoning may be this. And may I just point out to you how I'm being overly stupid, but to point out that this is the prevalent contemporary evangelistic mindset. You got to be like them to be effective with them. And the reasoning would be, look, if I enter into that circle of friendship with the sinner, then I'm going to have more frequent opportunities to be a witness. Now, if you put that into play, here you have your gang of thieves and muggers, and they're going down the street, and while they're sticking some old lady up with a pistola, you say, "No, look, that's wrong. You shouldn't do that. You shouldn't take advantage of this person. There's a better way, you know." Now think about how unreasonable that is. But again, I say that the prevalent contemporary evangelistic model involves the personal witness to integrate him or herself into the mix so as to be as much like them as possible, to have their ear, so to speak. But here we point out to you that in this 10th verse, if sinners entice thee, the last part of the verse says what? Consent thou not. And over in verse 15, my son, walk not in the way with them, refrain thy foot from their path. And so again, I say that the foundational premise in personal evangelism is separation. There's got to be that distance maintained between the one who has the truth and the one who has no clue about the truth, so that whenever the truth is uttered, there will be some credible testimony given to the individual. I mean, after all, do you not neutralize your words to the sinner, to the target, if you engage in the same activities or embrace the same mindset as they do? How can you possibly claim the high moral ground if you're down in the slop with them? It's not possible. The Apostle Paul tells us in Ephesians chapter 5 and verse 11, have no fellowship with the unfruitful works of darkness. Now, so again, we come back to that potential puzzle. How in the world can we have an effective blanket-like testimony to them if we separate from them? And I think we'll probably eventually get to the solution here, but as it concerns refraining the foot about this, imagine now. Probably one of the godliest Hebrew men that's spoken about in the Bible is Joseph. And he provides a perfect illustration of what it means to refrain the foot from. You remember that Joseph was an employee in the house of an Egyptian magistrate. And there was a time when the lady of the house, she put her eyeball on old Joseph and she was looking him over. And her husband would get up in the morning, have his toast and coffee, out the door to work he goes. But Joseph was the household manager. And he had a certain amount of trust with the boss. But the old woman, she kept after him, kept trying to entice him. And he kept rebuffing her. Now, put in play the modern notion of complicity by saying, well, look, maybe once or twice it's not going to hurt. That way I can have a good rapport with her. You know, there came a day then when the old lady made a grab for him. And the scriptures in Genesis 39 say this: he got himself out. He got himself out. Now, we'll point out this to you. You say, well, you know, it's usually always true that whenever you do the right thing, good things happen. But did good things happen to Joseph even though he did the right thing? No, he went to jail. And why did he go to jail? Because of a lie. Which means to say that you never should compromise integrity for the sake of expediency. And Joseph could not, should not, and he did not reason thusly, that if I let her have her way here or there, maybe I can reason with her about the wrongness of this situation. But no, he got himself out. He refrained his foot. And basically the point I make is, with regard to the target in mind and the trouble that they're in constantly and the trouble that they cause, and in light of where that trouble will ultimately lead them, they must see, the sinner must see, something radically different in us and something remarkably brighter about us so as to facilitate a credible appeal. Which comes into this mind, turn you, in verse number 23. But if, and see, if he is enticed into the gang and becomes part of the group, turn you becomes ineffective because you and me, we're into the same thing. So what gives you the right to tell me to turn when you're involved in the same thing? So you have then this to consider. Of course, when you think about turning it, you turn them out of darkness to the light. You turn them away from death to life. And how is that accomplished? Well, God's way is telling in verse 20. There's the word crieth and uttereth that appears two times each, but they're four different words. And they do provide a great profile of the nature of the telling. The first one, in verse 20, crieth, wisdom crieth without, is a word that literally means to shout. And now I'm not going to advocate that in the way of personal evangelism that you take up the lunch board placard and make a raving fool of yourself in the public marketplace. What this is hinting at is when it speaks to shout, it has in mind the notion that we should not be shy about vocalizing our message whenever there is an opportunity to put it in play. We shout as a versus a whisper. Shout versus obscurity. Okay, so wisdom crieth without, she uttereth. Now, uttereth doesn't so much have anything to do with the actual communication, but the manner in which the crying, it does have a sniff of weeping in it, passion and emotion, so that the individual that you're telling sees that you're not just simply some cold-hearted, hard-hearted, theological ogre that's demanding his or her own way in academia. There's something to be said about weeping. And then the other ideas there in verse 21 where it talks, she crieth in the chief places of the concourse. That word cry there means to literally to accost a person. You know what I mean by that? Picture now the whole realm of the thing, the sinner. He's about ready to leap on his victim. Okay? And you are there. Now, you know, most people, especially in the big cities, I don't know how things would go in the country. I've read pleasant exceptions to the rule. But, you know, some people will pass right by a crime without saying a word. They'll see something happening terrible to somebody and they'll turn the head and keep on going. That's none of my business. It doesn't directly affect me. So I'm sorry. I'm too busy to... They won't say a word. This word cry here means to accost a person. That whenever you see the sin, you confront the person. Now that's not something that's part of modern contemporary evangelism. No, we've got to take the edge off of it. And we've sort of like got to diplomatically work our way up to the discussion. But nothing will get a person's attention more than this. And would you disagree with me? Nothing will get a person's attention quicker than this. You just sinned. That was wrong. Now, you better be ready to give an answer should the question come, what are you talking about? What makes that wrong? What did I do wrong? You shouldn't have said that. You shouldn't have done that. Your thought on that was wrong. It's sin. Now the door is wide open for discussion. And it says there in verse 21, she cries in the chief places of concourse, in the opening of the gates, in the city, she uttereth her words. That word uttered there means to challenge. To challenge. And I will also mention to you this in verses 20, 21, there are four places that are mentioned there. First of all, this telling is appropriate in the streets. That's in public. And there's mentioned here in verse 21, the chief place of concourse. That's where people congregate. That's into the marketplace. And the opening of the gates doesn't have so much to do with a location as it does with the time. The opening of the gates at the start of the shift, when the business opens, or at your first opportunity of the morning if you're talking about family members. Breakfast time at the first of the day is the best time to have this conversation, when everything is fresh and there are no other distractions, when a person's not worn down in the course of their daily activity. That's what it's talking about in the opening of the gates. And in the city, you realize, think about this. Now, this is another part. This is another tragic, sickening part of modern, contemporary evangelistic model. Do you realize how many churches like our own, and I'm going to keep it in the narrowest little circle of Bible-believing fundamentalist churches, have now this notion, this model of evangelism, where they move out of the cities. They move out of the cities. Here we find that this telling is appropriate in the city. Now, you know what we do? Think about this, how ridiculous it is. Fundamentalist Bible preaching churches, for the most part, move out of the cities into the suburbs. They sell their property, and that's why you have a lot of these old, elegant church cathedrals now being used as theaters, or bar rooms, or spas. You know, the church decided that they were no longer effective in the city, so they moved to the country. And then you know what they do? They turn around and they get up a mission programs to have an outreach to the city folk. They're going to pay missionaries to go on a mission field trip to the city and pass out tracts. Well, wouldn't it be more effective for the people who live in the city and are part of that church to be living testimonies and personal witnesses to the people who live left of them and right of them on an everyday basis, rather than getting up a gang of teenagers and going to the city and having a missions trip? Now, that does salve the conscience of the youth director and the pastor of the church, but it really isn't much effective in a long term of reaching the people in the city. If I sound a little bit animated about it, I am. You know, in the Gospel of Luke, there's a place where it tells about going out into the highways and the hedges, compel them to come in. That's this notion of telling. And the reason is that my house may be filled. That my house may be filled. Then there's this, and I'll quit with this one. Verse number 23. Turn you at my what? Reproof. At my reproof. Is there a whole lot of evangelism that goes on in contemporary notion that smells of a reproof in the process of the message? The word here means to chastise or to correct or refute or rebuke error. No room here in this word reproof for evangelical political correctness. There is not to be any sugarcoating diplomacy in the message. You know, like, for what I mean is this. I've heard this before as a, shall I say, a evangelical, from the vantage point of those who champion evangelical success, those who notch their gospel pistols every time they lead somebody to the Lord. They usually have this lead in line, like as they sit down to the center and they say, you know, God has a wonderful plan for your life. Would you like to discuss the four spiritual laws? And I'm thinking, what? God has a wonderful plan? No, He doesn't. Here's the deal. If you don't turn from your sin and trust Christ, the plan for you is hell forever and the judgment, the righteous judgment of God upon your life. Turn you at my reproof. You can't continue to sin. Even though you say you're a Christian, you can't continue to sin and hope that God at last is going to be merciful on you, because that's not the case. Now, in spite of all that effort, some are going to turn away. And I'll leave it there. God's justice, His justice obliges Him to condemn the unbelieving sinner. And the sinner needs to be told that. And then when he says, well, what can I do about it? Oh, I'm glad you asked. There's this place in the Bible called Calvary. And at Calvary there was a cross, and on that cross hung a Savior. And that Savior invites sinners, but only sinners. Do you qualify? He only invites sinners to come. He only invites people who are condemned to die to come. Do you qualify? And he makes this promise that whosoever will may come, and whosoever comes, he will in no wise cast out. Won't you come tonight? And when he sees the passion in your telling and the tears that come out of your heart and an obvious concern for him or her, remember that if they hear and they turn away, that's not on you. The seed's been sown, and that's all you're responsible to do. So, can I ask you this? How many of you remember what the third element of our ministry plan for Grace Baptist Church is? To reach out. And how many of you remember the nuts and bolts of that plan of action? What did it require in the simplest form? Did it require on our part a mass evangelistic effort? Or each one, reach one? Each one, reach one. In light of the calamity down the road, should be all the incentive and motive that we would require. I'll leave it with you for you to think about and pick it up at the next earliest opportunity.